Yes, anything over that is accepted. So for the privilege of hearing Bennett Ledwin, it's $5. So make sure that you pay your server, and the tip is not included in your bill here. So make sure you pay before you go, else the philosopher's forum is stuck with it. Let's see. Oh yeah, we do need a volunteer to help us with culture, media, audiovisual, technological support, that sort of thing. Not that our kin is dying or anything, but we do need some younger blood. The vampire is taking all of ours out. Let's see. Future talks. Let's see. For everyone, we have a schedule for the fall, starting with tonight, and then going through December. So Carla and David have some copies up out there for you. Tonight, of course, we have Bennett Ledwin. In 2 weeks, we have Environmental Guilt and Shame by Dr. Sarah Fredericks, followed by Let a Thousand Gas Wells Bloom in October, and then by Jeff Foster, Ph.D., J.D., Ph.D., Is God a Figment? The Psychology of Religion, Thoughts, Reflections, and Inquiries. That ought to be interesting. And then followed by Interreligious Dialogue by Dr. James George of UNT. And then The World in 2034, Ethical Conundrums, Challenges and Issues by our very own president, Robin Olson. And then followed by Happiness, that we really need more of that in December. Now, without further ado, I'm going to introduce our distinguished speaker.
Were you going to ask about the response to the Jeopardy?
Response?
Yeah, like, do we want to keep doing it in summer?
Yeah, did everybody that went to Jeopardy or attended enjoy it? Would you like to see more of it and
yes.
do it again?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. All right. Yeah. At least two said yes. Okay. Bennett Ledwin and I have been friends ever since we met. We just sort of had this camaraderie, I guess, a meeting of minds and whatever. Although we have, you know, very different backgrounds, we both have written books, but very different kind. Bennett was born in a big town, Pittsburgh, Kansas. Is it as big as Pittsburgh, Texas?
About the same size.
About the same size. Okay. Well, he came to the big city and he graduated from Hillcrest High School and then went to Washington University in St. Louis where he got a degree in business. He tells me that before he graduated, he did 2 years of carpentry. Union carpentry?
Yep.
Were you a card-carrying union guy?
1947 was the union number.
Oh, my goodness. In Florida, and he says, what self-respecting Jew would at least attempt the trade? Well, so you did. And it made you humble, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Witnessing my skill as a carpenter, my foreman strongly suggested I go back and get my degree. Which he did. Okay, so he says public speaking is easier on the back. That's true. Bennett, after that, went into commercial real estate where he spent 30 years or so here in Dallas. But has a second life and now works with producing and screenwriting, TV and movie plays. He's published several books. Published several books, including the one he's going to speak on tonight, Brilliance, and they are for sale. And his co author and illustrator, he's also here, Jay Hsu, the co-author here, and the illustrator in the book. And Jay is also a teacher. So, without any further ado, I'm going to let Bennett tell you about his book, Brilliance.
David, turn the mic off.
I'm going to turn this off.
So this one's on?
It's on now.
Can y'all hear me in the back? Okay, thank you. I don't speak loudly. I need a microphone.
Or me.
Or Jay. My writing partner, Jay, is here, and he'll be part of the discussion tonight as well. And we'll try and keep him quiet in Q&A, but it won't happen, so just FYI. The book that we wrote is Brilliance, Understand the Creative Mind. This is the first of three books in the series. The series will be Brilliance, Understand the Creative Mind, first book. Second book is Brilliance, Managing the Creative Mind, which we'll get into the business aspects of creativity. And the third book, which we're not ready to publish yet or write, is Brilliance, Mastering the Creative Mind. So when we've mastered it, we'll write that book. Okay, the name of this talk is Birth of the Bestseller, Yes, I'm an Optimist. Okay, the obligatory, I need to see this. Jay, can I, good, I'll stand over here. Obligatory opening joke would be my impression of a T-Rex, a grateful T-Rex. Oh, can you see okay? A grateful T-Rex about to eat a meal. God is great, God is good, let us thank Him for our food. That's the response I was hoping for. Part of creativity is willing to fail. And so that joke just bombed. Thank you for sharing that. That's a very controversial joke between Jay and I because he hates my T-Rex jokes. And he wants me to be good at everything I do and everything I say. And I'm like, if we're going to talk about creativity, we've got to talk about failure. Because it's all about taking chances. If we do the tried and true, we know what our result's going to be. We've got to try new stuff. So, thank you again. Until about 20, 30 years ago, intelligence was measured primarily by two means, ability to focus and ability to memorize information. And that's who got the best AT scores, those are lawyers, doctors, storytellers. Back centuries, pretty much since the beginning of time, our smart guys were those guys. We all know, if you've read some of the books, A Mind at a Time, and some of these other books about various kinds of intelligence, social intelligence, language, motor intelligence, which is ability to do things, spatial, sequential. There's a lot of kinds of intelligence that aren't measured anymore by your ability to memorize information. And Google's the great equalizer in that because we can all look it up. So now it's going to be the new paradigm going forward is how can you put together things differently? The information is there for everybody to have. So we're going to divide this talk into three sections. It'll be people first, and then process, and then the product. So we're going to talk about people next. And I love, this is one of my favorite sayings, and I get to actually use it in front of you guys. You cannot separate the philosophy from the philosopher. What a great thing. So we're going to talk about people. First is my writing partner, Jay Hsu. Now, Jay is a true artist. I have come from this background. I studied business. I took accounting. I took finance. I was in commercial real estate, which we all know is the hotbed of creativity and spirituality.
That's a good one.
Thank you.
Better.
So we know it's not that. And my good friend, I've always had the desire to be a creative, but not the guts. I never want to be that starving actor, that starving artist. Jay's been willing to risk that, but Jay makes a great living. He teaches art in animation, 2D, 3D, graphic design. He's an Adobe professional. He's one of the smartest and most successful artists I know, and he hangs with the cream of the crop. He's done work for Comedy Central, Mary Kay,
Avon.
He's Fortune 500. He's doing some work with JCPenney now, and I'm not supposed to talk too much about it, but I will. He is the consummate artist and designer, and my good friend. And so, this book was actually his idea and not mine. And that's why that might fall there. One of the things that Jay told me, I think is probably a high number, 2% of all artists are professional enough to make a living at it. And if you think about the singers, painters, dancers, actors, directors, chefs, fashion designers, how many of them are actually making a living at it? So one of the things, now Jake teaches at SMU, Texas A&M, Collin County, UTD, and I'm probably leaving stuff out. Jake believes in giving back to the community. What he's learned, he wants to share. And that's kind of contagious. And I know that about this group, too, and the Philosophs, is that it's a community. What can we share? What can we give back? And I've got a little bit of that gene, and more so since I've become more artistic. Of course, I didn't voluntarily get out of real estate, but the market changed about 7 years ago, and it helped me make the transition. I'm a full-time writer now and producer. I produce a web series, and I've written 5 books and 20 feature scripts and a web series, and never been happier, never been less income. I'm making less money than I've ever made before, but I'm happier than I've ever been, too. So y'all have made career changes, and you know what I'm talking about. It's not always awesome.
Talk about how we didn't agree on this initially a little bit. I think that's interesting, because a lot of people may not agree.
I thought this number was extremely low, and since I've been out in the artistic world, I think it's probably high. If you think about in your life, how many people, and even in this room, the sculptors and painters and artists. Anyway, let's talk about my dad. I want to talk about mindsets. Any of y'all heard about the book Mindsets? Wow, it's awesome. Okay. Carol Dweck's a Stanford PhD, and she came up with this concept. Fixed mindset and growth mindset. We're talking about both of them. I come from two parents who are completely opposite in that regard. My father, by every measurable means, is a smart guy. Valedictorian, Phi Beta Kappa. Tried to get Rhodes Scholar, and he kind of got disappointed that didn't happen for him. Very successful real estate guy, because in his world, he understood great memory, great math skills, great logic, great ability to see the boundaries and the way things should go. First, how many in here like to be right? Raise your hand. Okay.
Being right are the people that aren't honest.
How many people are liars? No. Okay. Being right has zero to do with creativity. Okay. So I'd like to be right too, but it doesn't always work out that way. That would be called a fixed thinker. Someone who thinks that if you are smart, you will always be smart. If you're dumb or labeled dumb, you'll always be dumb. And that has a problem for people who are not genetically have those two categories, especially our generation. Most of the people here have a gray hair or two that are here. Some of y'all don't. I'm young people. Fixed thinking is a fairly rigid, competitive, and you measure yourself against others if you're a fixed thinker. How do I meet you? Am I taller than you? Am I better looking than you? Am I making more money than you? We all know those guys. I want to tell you a story. My little brother, is 2 years my junior, and we played chess growing up. And when he was about 8 and I was 10, he started beating me half the time, which was very insulting to me, because I'm the older brother. I should beat him in everything. I quit playing chess when we were about 11 or 12. I was 11 or 12 because I couldn't stand to lose to my little brother. Well, let's go forward 10 years. It turns out my brother tested in the top 100 math minds in the country in his senior year in high school. He aced right through MIT. He literally is a rocket scientist. I bought him that shirt that says, as a matter of fact, I am a rocket scientist. Sweet kid. He's even got that math thing where he stutters. I mean, he's just one of those guys. You're not talking about it. Yeah, it's like a real thing in the brain. So I quit playing chess because I couldn't stand to lose. And if I'd have had a different mindset, I might have become an amazingly good chess player. But I couldn't stand to lose, so I quit playing that thing. It hurt my ego too much. Let's go to Mom. Mom's an artist. Mom, I think, finished 1 year of junior college. Mom is way smarter than Dad. And I mean that. We'd go to mom for our problems because mom was an artist and had creative solutions. If we had an issue, creativity is what we needed. Just doing the same thing over and over again didn't work. So that was an early seed that was planted for me about a growth mindset, a person who looks at opportunities, isn't threatened by other people because they offer things that I don't know versus things that might burst my bubble of how smart I am. And the worst part about the fixed mindset is if you're smart, you're afraid to try new things because it might change your self-definition of I'm smart. And if you're dumb, you might continue to say, well, I'm dumb. I can't learn anything new. I was just reading Mindsets again today, and one of the quotes in there, gosh, I probably didn't read it, so I don't butcher it. But I can't even read, I'm too excited. that we're the people that start off the smartest don't always end up the smartest. If you work at it and you apply practice and research and do the things it takes to get better at something. So it's like the tortoise and the hare in that regard. Keep doing your thing. So mom's a great role model for me. She's in Who's Who American Art and in the MSC program, just sculpture and printmaking and painting, and she's one of my heroes. And my dad too, but different. They stayed together for one reason, because of their sense of humor. They had very little in common, but they enjoyed a lot. So it explains some of my loose screws. Scenario. There's an art teacher, and he says, I'm going to give you two choices. A sculptor. Make one pot. That's all you have to do to get your grade. Make one pot. Or just make, I don't care how many, just well, I'll grade you on pounds of pots. I don't care what they look like. How many think the one pot people made the best pots? Raise your hand. Okay. How many people, the people think that the one who made the pounds of pots made the best pots? Okay, very good. In every case, the people who made the most pots, no matter what they look like, learned the process. How thick the clay, how much water, how high to go, how fast the wheel. And so eventually they made better pots. So it has to do with making mistakes, going forward, getting your hands dirty, and trying new things. So that's a great one for me. I'm going to talk a little bit about the book. This is not a simple person's book. This is a smart person's book. We synthesized some really heady stuff, but we did it in such a way. This book being Jay's idea, it was for his art students, many of whom are dyslexic. They learn differently. Their minds are just structured different. A lot of right brain, you know, there's a misnomer about actually being right or left, but a lot of artistic type thinkers. And so I'll go to Jay's house. Jay designed two of my book covers, and then he designed a whole book. I wrote with an ex-wise guy turned cop, you can pass this around if you want, and he moved to Dallas from Brooklyn, and this is a couple of crime books that I wrote. Jay did these covers for us, and every time I'd go over to Jay's house, or we'd meet at Starbucks and not drink coffee, Jay would hand me a book and say, hey, Jay's a little dyslexic, he's not perfect. Jay can do everything, he reads a little bit slower than I do, but we have a lot of commonalities in our interests. He'd hand me a book. The first one he handed me was his Mindsets book. He says, I think you'll enjoy this. Well, Jay had another agenda. Dalai Lama is sort of my favorite book, Art of Happiness, and it is an art, and I love that. Jay had an agenda of writing a book for his art students, and he was secretly shopping for the right co-author. Okay, that was me. He liked my book, and when he designed this book, Letters to Adam, Diary of a Divorced Dad, he actually did the entire design and encouraged me to share some stories and pass that around, too. These are all available on Amazon. We developed a friendship and a trust because Jay saw what kind of parent I was, and Jay's got two kids that he's crazy about, and should be. They're great kids.
So he'd hand me books, and then the book was started. That was about 5 years ago. The book's been out for 3 or 4 months. It took us almost 5 years to get it done. We'll get into that.
Keep extending it. I'll say 4 years.
I'll say 4 years. Okay, it took us 4 years to do the book. Does that feel better?
That feels better.
Okay. I feel like I need to stop and do another T-Rex impression for you. My impression of a T-Rex coming back from a fishing trip. It was this big. A little bit, okay. It's the material or you're getting or the tacos are kicking in. Now we're talking about process. This is a big part of art, is process. A good friend of Jay's, and Jay did the slide presentation, did a talk called Design Like Da Vinci for South by Southwest, and it got about a quarter of a million hits on YouTube. It's a fabulous talk. If you want to go home and check it out, it's really good. Or see, is it not on anymore?
It's SlideShare.
Oh, SlideShare.
SlideShare. How many of you know what SlideShare is? All right. For smart people in the room, you need to know what SlideShare is. You need to go to SlideShare, look it up. All the conferences across the nation, when the speakers finish speaking at the conferences, they load their presentation up to SlideShare. Now, why is that important for smart people? Because often at the end of their presentation, they give you their email address or contact information. So if you're wanting to try to connect with some of the smartest people in the world, that's one of the best ways to do it. So if you didn't know about that, worth the price of admission. There you go.
Thank you. Without a microphone, Jay Shear, everybody. One of the greatest creators of all time, everybody would admit, Leonardo da Vinci created 13,000 pages of sketches. If you think about how many days he lived, that's a lot of sketches. Very prolific artist. You add up all these pages of Harry Potter, Hunger Games, and the Bible, that's about 13,000 pages. Kind of amazing. One of the things that's very little known is he only finished 30 pieces. He did 30 pieces in his entire life after 13,000. Okay? He was a perfectionist. He didn't get a lot done because of that. And that's a style. So those of you who have that issue, be aware. Finishing's part of it. Okay? Picasso, on the other hand, and this is a presentation Jay did with Brian Sullivan. Again, probably available on SlideShare? Okay. Picasso finished 147,800 pieces of artwork. Finished. Oh, my God. Great self-promoter, great artist.
They count them. This is from Guinness Book of World Records. He was also the most stolen artist in the world. Like, almost 1,300 of his pieces have gotten stolen.
Now, the reason I'm talking about this is those of you who are creatives or those of you who do anything, you have a Da Vinci style and Picasso style. You want to get it right, I'm not going to finish, that's Da Vinci, or good enough, that's Picasso. Now, Jay came up with the concept of the Da Vinci sandwich. You want to plan out your project, so it's certainly fine to be both of these things. Map it out, detail, outline. So Da Vinci, then go like gangbusters, Picasso, and at the end, Paul Tobolowsky finished his book. Anybody who has finished a book knows, start, middle, end. It's a different experience. So we talked about that. So yeah, it's a real thing. And so sandwich Da Vinci, Picasso, Da Vinci for our 2 cents. That's enough pieces to fill up a loop 4 times. I want to talk about, that relates to where we're going with this process of doing a book. Jay's a bit of a Da Vinci, I'm a bit of a Picasso. I want to say a year and a half, 2 years, and don't quote me on the years, Jay will yell at me again, but it's a long period of time. It's as if I was working for Jay. It was his idea, his book, his students, what can I do? I'm a writer, and I can take notes. So I delivered some writing to Jay, and it looked like this. It was a lot of text, and it was like, no. And I delivered it again. We digested some pretty complex books. Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, Lateral Thinking, the De Bono stuff, Mind Maps. So we took some pretty complex stuff. and I'm trying to digest it. And that's kind of my skill. Growing up between mom and dad, I had to translate all the time. So, and that's how I made a living. It's not that I was a great numbers guy, but I learned to speak different languages in English. So talk to the art, the banker, the lawyer, the, you know, dry cleaner, the landlord. I was a mediator, and that's how I made my living. So translating was my thing. And I just couldn't get it. I could not make Jay happy. And so after a year, year and a half of getting sample chapters, I'm like, Jiminy Jesus, Jay. I didn't use those words. Jay, I'm a writer. I'm not a mind reader. What the fuck do I have to do to satisfy you that your students are going to like this book? He goes, I don't know, but my art students are not going to read all that text. I said, well, what do I need to do? Take on the persona of an art student and pretend I'm one of them and write like I'm a 21-year-old female art student at Collin County Community College? He goes, that's a great idea. I'm like, okay. I write screenplays, so I write characters, and that was actually a fun challenge. A big risk. I mean, you know, can I do it? Will the world accept it? This is not a normal book, but we're not having normal clients. So he said, go out and buy The Princess Diary. Actually, I wrote some samples. A female artist buddy of his that wasn't a little too male still. So he says, go out and do some research. Go buy The Princess Diary. So what did I do? Because I'm such a great listener, I went out and bought Bridget Jones' Diary. And it was a great read. It was pretty sexy, pretty funny. And I'm like, and then we met. I go, Jay, I read that book. It's pretty funny. I'm not sure how it's going to be perfect for our, you know, art students. He goes, so you bought The Princess Diary? I look at the book and I go, no. I better go buy that book too. So I did. I read two books to develop the persona of a 21-year-old art student. And that is one of the vignettes that runs through the book. We have it's meta. If y'all know the concept, that meta is self-referential. We have a 21-year-old art student going to junior college, taking a class called Brilliance that has a lot of these informational books that we digested, and her teacher is a combination of Jay and I in the book. So, again, it wasn't without false starts. We designed a book cover, which I think is pretty cool, pretty slick. We did some market testing on that, and people said, it doesn't really sound like your book. It looks a little bit science-y, and so we did another iteration or something, and finally ended up doing a quite different cover, and we can pass that around too if you want to see that or the cover. We'll start that one. In the meantime, I was still creating. Jay was doing his thing. I was doing my thing. I did a web series, and it's out there on YouTube now. It's called Loaded. That's a character known as Badger Man. Not to be confused with Wolverine.
Oh, by the way, that's also Adam Whitman's son.
My son is the lead character. Now, we did a lot of secondary research from all those, De Bono and Brain Rules and all those books. But I want to do some primary research. So where do artists go and fail? Usually they're in their little room, and they're drawing and they throw it away or they delete it. Or they're singing in their music room and you don't ever hear it. Where can I see artists fail? So I go to Dallas Comedy House open mic night. The first comedian up there is a hillbilly in a three-piece suit with a washboard and a thimble, singing the nastiest rap songs I've ever heard. And he bombed. No one applauded. And I go, I am so in the right place. It was horrible. And some were good, some were not. Some were professionals working on their jokes. But that's where they do their workout. Jerry Seinfeld takes him a year to get a full hour set, just so you know. He goes three nights a week, and it's a lot of failure. What do they like? Where do they put the emphasis? What words work? That joke just didn't work. And you'll see him actually, guys get on stage and, okay, I better try that differently. I recommend open mic night. It's usually free. Hyenas has it, Dallas Comedy House. And I've taken a couple of improv classes here also, which is flying without a net, which is good for everybody. It kind of shakes your world up a little bit. One of the things I learned in improv was And this is great for all creatives. And when Jay and I do a seminar or a lecture, we'll probably have improv comics come teach. Yes, and. Now, if you've been in a meeting and somebody goes, no. Yeah, we've all been in that meeting. It shuts down the communication. There's nothing. Improv rules is, you're the most interesting person in the world. So whatever you say, I'm going to go, yeah, and. And so you keep the conversation going. And oftentimes, it's not the first idea is the one that we use. It's that pulling the scarf. And so if you're in a creative process, it is yes and. And it might be the seventh scarf that's the great idea. But if you said no, it shuts it down and you never get there. And there's another word I forgot. Is it De Bono that does the Poe thing? Poe is a word that means possibly, potentially. And Jay and I use that a lot. In the second book we go, well, what if she works for a corporation and she graduated school with like Poe? Which means maybe, let's think about it, the deal, it's still alive as opposed to no or yes, it's a possibility. So I invite, and anybody who's ever been in a relationship with another human being, it's a great word to have.
I'm going to interject it again. Okay. The couple things on yes and. Out of fear, a lot of people will be presented with opportunities and out of fear they'll say no. Because they don't know the outcome. They haven't done something before, so a lot of times they're afraid to try. Right? Or in business opportunities, romantic opportunities, friendships, all the above. Saying yes and means you try. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. Does that make sense?
Yes, and we're just going to cuddle.
Oh!
You should go there. Sorry. Do we have time? How are we doing on time, David?
We got 15 minutes.
We got 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
Okay. Do we have the speakers on?
No, we don't have the speakers.
Okay.
That's all right.
No. Tyrannosaurus Rex joke?
Yes, my impression of a T-Rex spiking a volleyball. You ask.
Yeah, tell them what happened at the other meeting.
At least they're always equally bad.
Yeah, thank you. I can count on Jack to critique me honestly. Thanks, Jack. This is a web series. We did 44 promotional videos, and then we have 6 scripted. My agent suggested I do something because nobody reads scripts anymore. So to sell a feature script, at least have something in the can or on YouTube. We're on Funnier Guy now with our scripted. These are the promos. And in fact, one of the reasons Jay up, we couldn't get Jay off of square one on the art. The book was written for about a year. And Jay's a very busy guy, so it wasn't, this is not his main occupation. If I hit this, will that pause it?
Oh, yeah, there's some other stuff.
You won't have to pause it.
We can skip this one anyway.
All right. Sorry, Dave.
That's all right. No. Oh, God, here we go. I play a character, too. I play a very feminine, fairly closeted Texas oil millionaire who's producing this web series. They came from Australia. Not really, we made all that up. That's the backstory for the actual scripted web series. What are we talking about? I was trying to stall for time on this thing. Jay.
Yeah.
Jay was having a hard time getting the artwork done.
Right.
And I'm a patient man. For Picasso, I'm extremely patient.
No, he's not. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, yes. What's going on, Jay? You know, we're good friends now. We're like, what's really going on? Because, honestly, and he hangs out with some world-class artists. I mean, the people that designed the Fifth Element.
The Masters of Science Fiction.
What's the one he's doing now? Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Spider-Man.
Oh, Guardians. Guardians.
But I'm saying Will.
Oh, Will.
Yeah, so Jay's introduced me to some amazing artists. They're like, wow. I mean, they're not household names because they're not Harrison Ford, but these guys do the artwork behind it, the design behind all these things. He goes, honestly, I'm afraid to put my artwork out there. I mean, he was very, because my peers will see it. And Jay's got a lot of different styles, but and I think he's a great artist. To me, he's amazing and very fun and very animated and very Hanna-Barbera for me and Disney, which is really sort of his models. But once we got to the answer, are we hooked up yet or no? Are we ready to go?
Oh, I don't know. We'll have to try this out.
Yeah, okay, we are. So once he saw me, I said, Jay, I'll put myself out here like this. You can put your artwork out there. Can you hear? Jay Christensen. Not talent, okay? And that's a promo, that's not scripted. So, now we'll move into the book. That, by the way, that got Jay, when Jay saw how willing I was to make a complete idiot out of myself, he goes,
okay. Well, when you haven't seen some of the other stuff, I mean, at one point he's literally picking stuff out of his belly button on film.
Yeah, my
into a bag. What is your
My disease? Character had a condition called super neonatal electromagnetitis, which is a lot of belly button lamp.
And we're not talking a little. We're talking like laundry bag.
I got the laundry. I got the lint from the laundry basket. Yeah. So it got Jay off the head and taking a chance. Okay. So now we have a book, which we'll talk about. One of the things I love most about this book, it is for artists. Can you see okay over there? Okay. Is the artwork. I'm a writer. I think I'm a pretty good writer, pretty funny writer. Jay's a good writer, too, and he put a lot of his lectures. There's about five books in one, in this, or six books. We have exercises, we have artwork, we have the narrative of the lady going through, we have the science, and we have, what else?
Illustrations, quotes,
and Jay's lectures. Jay did some of his classroom lectures in here, too. So if you just want to look at the pictures, you could have a good experience in this book. Almost probably everybody knows about the three-part brain, the reptilian, the mammalian, and the cortex. And so this is sort of a normal drawing, about as normal as Jay draws. And for these art students, it matters, it doesn't matter, they might pay attention to this drawing, but they all would remember this drawing. Okay. A man on top of a bear on top of a crocodile. And that's a great representation for me. It's one of my favorite drawings of a way that they would remember that for the test. Because, you know, this brain takes care of the automatic functions, and this is the emotionality, and this is higher thought. And we want these artists, these curators, everybody, to better understand themselves. The book is for three target groups. Artists to better understand themselves, or creatives to better understand themselves. People who love artists and want to better understand them. And then people who want to be more creative. So pretty much everybody. Because we all have that dyslexic kid or that wife who wants to take up photography or whatever. Did I say that loud? We have some charts like this, and I won't go into all the detail on this because of time, but fixed mindset versus growth. And we all have some fixed mindset, and that's how we were successful and make a living. I don't want to put that down. If my brain surgeon, I don't want him to be too creative. I want him to do exactly. And a pharmacist, yes, please weigh out exactly that amount of medicine. So fixed mindset in engineers is not a bad thing, but it's not a creative thing. And so it is open up to making mistakes and being wrong. Not on my brain, please, thank you. This group understands genetics, I'm guessing. The genetic, the genes' only function is to replicate. Okay. Sometimes there's mutations and those kinds of things, and there's a lot of doctors in here. And I want to do one quick digression. Our good friend, Dr. Charles Barker, did a lecture the other day about compassion and creativity, and he said there is no compassion without creativity. But you have to be able to see somebody else's perspective. He's really big in the Charter for Compassion, as you all know. And when he said that, it made me feel like our book and our mission about spreading the creativity thing is more than just for artists. It's for everybody living, seeing somebody else's perspective, trying a new thought on and see how it works. So that was really a moving lecture that Charles did a couple weeks ago. Memes are just like genes, and that the new genetics is the science of genes, mimetics is the science. Those of you who have read or seen Virus of the Mind, he talks a great deal about that. And memes, primary function is to replicate. It's not about good, bad, morally. Wants to have more fun is a meme. And that may be carried on for 50 years since that ad came out in the 60s. But, and several religions are all memes too. And every thought we have is a meme. So there's no right or wrong meme, absolutely. And talking philosophers, I think, could probably get a lot of agreement in here, but in certain areas and churches in town, probably wouldn't get agreement. It's divinely inspired, but everything comes through our brain, so it's all human construction, so it's all memes. We talked about that some. This is one of Jay's success lectures, and I just love this. There's no shortcuts to success. You know, you can't, you're going to run up the ladder. So some of these things are more for students. A 21-year-old, this might be more than to the 55-year-old physician in the room or whatever. We talked about adrenaline meter, how people, when they get into their mammalian brain, their thought process changes. Jay likes to talk about the high school girl who isn't thinking anymore rationally when she's kissing her boyfriend, and those things happen. So with all of us in that meeting, if you get into your emotional state, and it's funny, I've done this talk, various variations of this now, 5 times. What one book club, this was the most meaningful thing to one lady. She says, I get so mad in those meetings, I can't think and I can't talk. And she was aware that she got into, her adrenaline got up, and she lost her ability to function at a high level intellectually. Because that's what happens when we get that adrenaline.
I'm gonna interject a little bit. We've simplified this. I mean, one of the groups that you talked to with doctors basically said there's a lot more than adrenaline going on in your brain when you're making these things. But everybody recognizes when you're starting to get angry, and then when you start to get to that threshold, and then you kind of lose your cool, or you get happy and you're so happy that you're not thinking anymore, or so sad that you're not thinking anymore. And it really does, once you pass your threshold, the brain literally cuts off the connection to your higher functioning brain, and you go into a fight or flight response, and you just kind of are acting, right? And that's something that we found out. And that really resonates with my students, because when they get too scared, they shut down.
We'll address those, or the other couple of endorphins.
Okay.
Jay is he's such a sweet and compassionate human being that he really wanted to talk about depression. Because every artist, let's think about that for a second. There's a reason why people become very fixed mindset. If I know what's going on, I know what to expect, I do what my preacher says, I do what my parents say, everything's going to be okay. As opposed to somebody that says, I'm going to reconstruct the world, I'm going to deconstruct the world and reconstruct the world every day, because that's how you create. You have to take the world apart. And some days, it's just too apart. And I don't know how to get back to a middle ground. And so every artist at one time or another has suffered or feels depression. As we all probably do, but it's because we don't know what's going to happen, we get overwhelmed, and so there's a lecture, Jay does some of these success lectures that are tied with some pictures, and we talk about dealing with the real issues and not just medicating, although medication is okay, blah, blah, blah. We're not going to dwell on this slide, but it's a real thing. Emotionality is a real part of every human experience, and creatives have that probably more than your straight-ahead fixed thinkers. Pleasure versus happiness. Dalai Lama talks about that. Happiness is different. Pleasure is genetic and simple, and anybody can satisfy himself, please himself by having a Diet Coke or an enchilada or sex. That's easy. It takes no brain, no thought. Happiness is a different thing. Happiness is from what you do and what fulfills you and makes your brain, challenges your brain and your growth. And so we talk about that a little bit too. I just think that's a great picture. I love this one too. Back in the old days, if you were an artist, you were working for really rich people or the church or the same thing. So that's why you don't see a lot of pretty women necessarily in all the old pictures. Take my wife, please. It tickles me. And then the church, they're always marketing, so you like it the walls, it's a paint of the ceiling. Creativity comes from relationships of ideas combined in new ways. What we did with this book was very little discovery of ourselves. It's the way we presented it, and the manner we presented it is our creativity and our add to this thing. Most creatives take existing things, you know, a T-Rex and an old Jew doing a Baruch HaTar Noi anyway. Thank you, Rob. Jack smiled. John, that's a victory.
Smiling at Rob.
Yeah, poor Rob, he thought that was funny. We did a little science or pseudoscience, but for a creative, there's an area in our brain where we combine the new ideas. It's called the prefrontal cortex. It's right up front. It's where the actors get on stage, and you might get two different actors, three different actors playing the scene, and that's where we combine the ideas. I'm going to hear this from all my doctors. Your science was not right. But it's pretty close. There is a place in our brains. It's called prefrontal cortex. It's not that big, and there's no little man standing there. But I think those artists will remember it.
And you know what? We're talking about fixed thinking versus growth thinking, too. If you're always concerned about what the right is, the idea, right? It's getting people to think about the idea.
The concept.
Right.
The book called Mind Mapping that we just love, the Buzon brothers, basically won all kinds of awards for. You find the central idea. Most of us take notes. We just take notes. Nowhere in our brain is there straight lines. And yet we take notes in straight lines. We have to break it down into binary code, bring it back up into binary, into what those curves look like. This is a lot closer to how our brains actually store information and work. And you have a central idea. This is basically the word of the book, creative mind, psychology, thinking styles, and biology. And there's books on every little thing, every little slide. Don't have time tonight. It's cool. Mind mapping is a great way to take notes for anything and to illustrate in a meeting what you want to say. This is the thing, and anyway. For our book, we took three of the over 60 neurotransmitters. Thank you, Dr. Paul Tobolowsky, for telling me that there's over 60. He says you need to be careful about being so narrow. This is a creative book. Nora is a personification of norepinephrine, which is adrenaline in our brain. Dopamine is dopa, and sera is serotonin. We personify those. We think people can remember those better. And again, an aggressive, get after it, a fun dopamine. And why kids learn so easily, they just bathe in dopamine. Everything is new. So that's why childlike, the sillier I get, the better I write, especially comedy. Because your dopamine happens. Ironically, a lot of managers who manage creatives, and why the second book is going to be great, is you need the right mix of attention, focus, and fun. So I'm actually going to sit down and write my script today. If I'm just out here, I'm swimming, I'm playing, I'm going looking for tennis in a lunch date, okay? If I just have adrenaline, okay, I need to get it done. Go ahead, darn it. Okay, it's not going to work. So you need the right mix. A lot of managers, is that for me? Oh. A lot of managers in the creative business, and that's why the second book is really important, and Jay's like all over that one. You have a creative team that has some dopamine, and they're trying to, you know, a lot of these creative companies now have ping pong tables and pool tables. Their break rooms look like game rooms. To encourage that sort of fun behavior, that fun thinking, those fun chemicals. Boss comes in there and says, I need by the end of the day or you're fired. How does that work?
it dumps a bunch of adrenaline into your brain, it shuts down the dopamine, and now I'm stuck. So there is chemistry to creativity as well. And so, and even moderating your own, how hard you are on yourself versus I got to do 20 pages a day, how's that working for you? Well, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. We talked about that. And this is a vote speech, which is one of Jay's lectures, which I really like, and it's about locus of control, whether it's the environment or myself. And sometimes you don't have control, and sometimes you do, and you do the best you can. And again, I cut it short just because I want to have time for some Q&A. And one final T-Rex joke, which I'll leave you with. Thank you, David, for laughing ahead of time. My impression of a T-Rex who's heard enough. Blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
Question.
I'm glad to see you use fun and process as part of the, well, let me call it the process of creativity. She says, Mahaley, you know, created flow. My the corresponding leader in this was my mentor, who we focused on facilitating creativity among students from kindergarten into graduate school. I'd like your comment on this, because this was a longitudinal study that started in 1960s and 2010. But it was discovered that students today in school, their creativity, according to these, there are 8 measures here, went up until about 1980. In the 80s, it started to go down. Now, one hunch I have is that students don't have much fun in school anymore, and they don't have time to relax. But I'd like to hear your comments about how this could apply to young people.
I'm going to get up now.
We'll probably hear from Jay on this, too. What was the 80s was called? What was that decade called?
The
80s? The me decade? Was that the me decade?
No, that was 70s, the me decade.
Was it?
I think.
I don't remember. I do think that fun has to do with other people. You find kids that you like to play with. It's absolutely the education system. And Jay's going to have a lot of fun thoughts about this. I'm going to steal one of his lines, but he calls it academic bulimia, where we teach them to learn information and repeat
bulimia?
It back. Academic bulimia. Where they eat it and they throw it right back up. And I regurgitated this thing and now I get the A, as opposed to the kid who didn't memorize it but he had other ideas. I remember in business school I learned pretty early on not to be too creative with my papers in business school. They wanted to hear what they wanted to hear, not what my ideas might be about the slave economy and the Civil War and the way they were sabotaging. You have a hard-working guy up north, and you have the slaves kind of taking their time down there, and climate. It's hot in the south. Nobody moves as fast. They want to hear those kinds of esoteric ideas. So I think it has to do with conformity, and the 60s were nonconformist. And again, I'm a real estate guy. I went to business school. I'm up here talking about creativity and T-Rex jokes. So I've had to make some changes personally, a great deal, and God bless my significant other. She's put up with going to work, real estate guy, crazy artist. She's not here, by the way, tonight, just FYI. But she's heard this talk before. I think it has to do with interaction with others, education, and conformity. Probably conformity is probably number one.
Teachers have to teach to the test now.
Yeah, right.
They don't enjoy it.
That's right.
Those that are creative.
Better got ahead of me a little bit, but I think we should applaud his and we really got 2 for 1. We got, you know, Jamarla Party.
3 for 1.
Whatever. So I think both of them can answer questions, and they want to encourage
audience participation, so if anybody have...
Or comments, just tell us with all that.
I guess maybe disagreeing a little bit about the characterization of certain occupations because he picks thinking, and particularly the example you gave with an engineer. And it comes to mind, a lot of engineers are inventors.
So I love that. Thank you.
Are they creative in that respect?
Go ahead.
You know, what's really interesting is I just started at JCPenney. And JCPenney is by nature a very introverted organization. And you can probably tell, so am I, right? No, I'm not. I'm very out.
That's the quietest he's ever talked in his life, right there.
So when I came on board, there was the most outgoing of the introverts, and he and I connected. But the room was so quiet that even I was getting like, oh, I'm hearing my voice a lot, so why don't I just tone back more than I normally do? So what I think happens, and I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of extroversion versus introversion, is the job that you do, the process that you do, accesses certain parts of your brain. And so because of that, you have a tendency to take on what we'll call a persona, in which you behave and act a certain way to get your job done. When I paint, I'm very, very quiet. Does that make sense? Now, when I'm talking and moving around and socializing, I'm very extroverted. So I think in terms of creativity, that's also something. If you're not creative or you don't practice being creative, once you get to a certain age, people have a tendency to think they're not creative. And that meme and that mindset takes over. They go, I can't draw. So you don't try.
One other thing, too, I have a lot of these favorite sayings. Every good artist is part scientist, and every good scientist is part artist. So I agree with you, and the good ones have both. And our thing is to encourage dialogue. I love that you said that. I love disagreement, because that's where we can sort of find, yeah, okay, right, good.
Yeah, there are a lot of creative engineers.
Could you make any comments regarding the cultural aspects of creativity? People from different countries that I've known, and I'm from a different country, have grown up looking at creativity, of being smart, being an artist, being a scientist, in different ways from which most of you have grown up seeing. And to me, it's very obvious, but I don't know if you have any observations on that.
It's very cultural. Did y'all hear the question? Okay. Within even art communities, there's culture. If you're talking to a group of actors, it's different than a group of painters. So it's not just country cultures. There's cultures within cultures within cultures. And the idea that we're all the same, there's a book called Mind the Time, I quoted before. It's a pediatrician. He's interviewing some school teachers. And one school teacher says, well, I treat all the kids the same. And the doctor said, oh my God, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Because they're not all the same. And so every culture is different. And then you learn the norms of your culture. How far can I go? With our comedy, for example, comedy is a great example of higher thinking. Comedy is violation. You don't laugh. If it's a fact that you know, you're not going to laugh. If it's something that's too outrageous, you're not going to laugh. If it just crosses that line enough, oh, I didn't think it would go there. It startles you. It violates your sensibility in such a way that it makes you laugh. And that's why the funniest joke in the world is a bland joke, because it doesn't really violate anybody enough to make anybody else laugh. So they've done surveys on that. I don't know if I answered your question or not, but culture is what we're trying to change.
Yeah, I'll try to answer your question, I think, a little bit, maybe more where you're coming from, but
okay.
You'll let us know. When I grew up, my dad would let me have pieces of paper to draw. But when I started to go to college and I said, you know, Dad, I think I want to study art in college, he said, no. I think you should do business. I think you should do management because you have good people skills. So they really
did not support me becoming an artist. Okay? I have friends who are Hispanic, and their parents, it's almost like, oh my gosh, it's the artist, thank God. Right? We have an artist in our family. Wonderful, right? And I think that different cultures do support, and they say, you know, even if you don't make enough money, it's a gift. Right? And we need to support this gift. Picasso family supported his gift. What a lot of people don't know in the talk we did with Produce Like Picasso is he went to Paris and failed 4 times. He had to go home, and one time he almost starved. And he went home almost very sick and took time to recover. It was only his 4th time going back to Paris that he made a modicum of success, and that's when he took off. So a lot of people don't realize that failure is part of being successful, and if you don't have family support, it is hard to be a comedian or a dancer or an artist.
And I want to address that one more way differently. Status quo is what culture is. We live in the United States, it's not monolithic, but we have the status quo of two-party system. Change only happens when you do something different than status quo. Mm-hmm. So in every culture, there's going to be a pushback against artists at some level. Because this is what we know, this is what we do. Why would you change that? Look at your father. He's used the same plow for, you know, his grandfather and that father. And you want to drive a tractor? What's wrong with you? It's good enough for your dad, it's good enough for you. Most people with the same religion, their parents were too, which I find not ironic, but it's sort of strange to don't encourage to explore it. So do you want status quo or do you want to explore? And that's culture, that the meme thing. Replicate the meme that you heard before. Do what's gone on before. And so it takes, of course, you know how they domesticate wild animals, don't you? You know what I'm talking about? They take the most ornery rams that are out there and they castrate them. Because they want to have the calmer rams replicate.
They do that in corporate America, too.
Yes.
It seems like part of the process of converting creativity into some sort of tangible accomplishment is maybe self-criticism or learning from those failures. And I wonder if you could talk about whether there's any tension between those two. It seems just like my own experience.
Huge.
You have a brainstorm one day and it seems like the best idea in the world, and the next day you wake up and say, wow, that's crazy. And how do you, you know, keep an even keel so you can...
What's an even keel?
Well,
yeah. For an artist, I don't think so, but yeah. I'd like to address that. Well, I'd like to address that. In fact, I just read that today. The people who are most self-critical or most self-aware are most accurate about their own strengths and weaknesses. If you're in a fixed mindset, you're in denial about a lot of things.
Yeah.
You think you're smart at everything because you're smart at something. You're not aware of your deficiencies. So it is a continual, and it's a battle being an artist. It was a lot easier being a commercial real estate broker. Buy, sell, $1 million, $1,050,000, sold. There's not a lot to do there. But when you're writing comedy, is this funny? Oh my God, and I write better jokes than T-Rex, I promise.
Yeah, I'm gonna take the privilege to ask a question. Many people have some creativity, and you know, when they're in the first grade, they do scribble and draw all kinds of stuff. And sometimes this is encouraged, and sometimes it's squelched.
Sure.
Tell me, what percent do you think is kind of innate? I'm going to put that in quotation marks.
Okay.
And how much do you have to cultivate? You know, like you may have a musical talent, but you can't be a concert pianist until you practice. And
right.
So practicing, and as a kind of a messier writer, I started, you know, maybe just 10 years ago to write.
Sure.
And I belonged to a writer's group, and it was terrible writing. And I went home, you know, crying. I thought, I shouldn't be a writer.
Well, you practice and you
welcome to being an artist.
Better, just like yeah. So how much is innate and how much is talent?
No, no, damn it, no, go ahead.
I said I've written 20 screenplays. I've written 6 good screenplays. You got to get it out. It's just, you have got to do all those pounds of pots. And I've got pounds of scripts. So it is about practice. Well, I'll let Jay talk about that because Jay followed his bliss more than I did. I'm late to the game, like you are, David. It took me into my... Well, I've been writing for 20-something years, but I didn't follow it because I wanted to make money instead. It isn't all bad. Go ahead.
I teach at a community college as well, and a lot of times we'll have older students, and so it's kind of a two-part answer. First of all, I think I have a theory about nature versus nurture. Okay, you know, everybody says, is it nature, is it nurture, is it genetic, is it environment? And my little theory is this: people move towards environments that they feel comfortable. Right? You find people that you connect with and you say, these are my people. And these people hang out at this place. So I'm going to hang out at this place. Which is why I believe social psychologists find that the environment really influences people, because you're attracted towards a particular place. And I think innately, artists are attracted to certain people and certain places. And I think if you're an artist, and this is from having 40, 50-year-old students come and say, my 8th grade art teacher told me I wasn't any good and I should stop drawing. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. And it really pisses me off, quite honestly. Because I don't think an 8th grade art teacher has the right to tell somebody that they're not good and that they should stop drawing. Because when you're that young, you tend to listen to those authority figures, and that can really change your life. And these people are in my class again because they're not happy. They're not doing what they were innately meant to do. And I think if you're an artist or a dancer or a poet or a writer, there's this voice inside of you that says, you know what, there's something missing in my life. There's something I'm not doing, and I have to do this whether I want to or not.
Yep. David, there's a question over here, too. And by the way, nobody should be a writer or a golfer. Either you have to do it or don't do it. It's just too hard. Okay, Chip, and then one over here, one after that, okay? Okay.
This is more of a comment in regards to your comment about sometimes you have a good idea and then you wake up the next day and you're like, well, that wasn't that great an idea. I just finished taking a class, a writer's law class at UTV called Managing Innovation Within the Corporation, and it was...
It should be green.
There you go.
The whole premise was not every idea you're going to come up with is your best idea, but write all the ideas down and then go through a culling process of saying, all right, well, we'll invest a little bit to kind of develop this idea and that idea, but then we're going to evaluate again and see if it's worth investing more into this idea. I'm a very creative person and an engineer, and I come up with tons of ideas. Just last weekend, I came up with 6 ideas for new businesses, things that don't exist. Okay, well, that's probably about 200 man years worth of work, if they were all to be implemented. Well, not all of those are going to be ideas which, if I did some investigation, they would all
pan out.
Maybe there's too much competition in some areas, maybe some of them, the technology is really not quite there. But from the creative standpoint, I just write them all down, and then I can think about them and think about their viability a little bit later.
No, just make sense. He said he was making a comment. Yeah. That's part of my thesis. That was good. Thank you.
That was good, Steve.
Did you have anything to do with the tree man in Guardians?
No. My friend Stephane Martinet is considered to be a master of science fiction. He lives here in Dallas. He created some of the ships and concept art for Guardians. But no, a lot of people want to be responsible for Grog, and no, that wasn't him.
I actually saw some pictures of yet, where it's filled with little trees.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's a popular thing.
All right. We have a question over here.
Okay. So, thank you, Patricia.
I wanted to hear something from either one of you about the whole issue of focus. It's actually kind of a follow-up to one of the earlier comments. There was a column written in the Chronicle of Higher Education a couple of years ago about focusing on writing, and the short version is that there are people, of course, you know, who can always talk about what it is that they're going to write, but
sure.
they never do it.
Sure.
And they're always the most brilliant people in the room, except the fact that they're not actually producing anything.
Right.
But the people who are actually productive with their creativity are the ones who are willing to feel stupid about what it is they're doing, because they're failing repeatedly. And they keep attempting, they keep failing, but of course eventually they do start to husband those ideas and make them productive. But it takes a degree of focus, but it also requires that you be willing to accept that along with what
he
was going to be stupid, and of course, going to fail.
Well, let me get this first. But yes, Tyrannosaurus jokes, exactly. Okay, so the Produce Like Picasso speech that I did, and again, it's on the slide here if you want to take a look at it. We came up with 5 P's of productivity because we said we wanted to examine how was Picasso so productive, and how was he successful in his lifetime? Because the cliche is, you know, artists aren't successful until after they die. Right, that's when their art is really worth anything. He actually made a lot of money during his lifetime, okay? So Brian and I came up with this idea of, you know, Da Vinci versus Picasso, but Picasso was extremely disciplined. He had a schedule and he stuck to it every day. He'd have his day routine, he'd have a siesta, go swimming, take a break, he'd eat dinner with his friends, and then he had his next routine that he'd work until about 2 in the morning and start that all over. Without consistent focus and discipline, you're never going to be very productive. And a lot of artists fall into this trap of, I'm only going to draw when I feel like it. Well, guess what? When you come home from working, you probably don't feel like writing, or you don't feel like painting, you don't feel like drawing, because you're tired. And so most people don't. And they have this idea they will someday, magically, they're going to have all this time, and it never happens, right? So they don't get it done. So if you really want to be a professional artist, you have to figure out discipline and do it on a consistent basis. I mean, no matter what it is, dancing or comedy or whatever you're going to do, if you don't do it on a regular basis and with discipline, you're never going to be very productive, no matter how great the ideas are. Right? And that's something I've noticed. The other thing, real quickly, is Picasso was an egotist. And I have a feeling he knew his stuff wasn't good sometimes. So to get over that fear, his answer to fear and perfectionism was more narcissism. He basically said, I'm perfect, so everything I do is perfect. Right? And sometimes you got to be that way. You just got to trick yourself into saying, you know what? It's awesome, because I get it.
Same thing with writers.
Yes.
They're told, you know, write everything. Write
right.
something every day.
Just
Or read. Stephen King, we can't all be Stephen King, reads 5 hours a day and writes 5 hours a day.
Been a lot of speculation in media lately about the correlation, maybe causation, between creative genius and various kinds of mental problems. Beethoven, Van Gogh,
well, I'm a living
Isaac
example.
Newton,
yeah, go ahead.
And Robin Williams come to mind.
Sure.
I wonder if you have anything to say about that.
Absolutely. That's sort of the easy, that's the low-hanging fruit for me. You're taking the world apart. It's not what you and I see as a table. They're seeing as a putting green with a lot of obstacles, and it's not those givens, those things that ground us to living are not the same for the artist. I got to tell you, I became a full-time artist about 6 years ago, my sense of direction was fantastic before, and now it's not as good. My brain is wired differently. Now I'm smarter, and one of the things that I love about this Mindsets book, and if you pick up that book before you pick up ours, that's fine, but it's that intelligence is not a fixed thing. We can get smarter or dumber. And the kids that start off the smartest don't always end up the smartest. And so, creativity is that thing. The universe is not fixed. It is a moving... Beethoven might have seen notes and walked into traffic because he was taking apart the universe that way. So I think that's the easy answer is those creative geniuses are not living on the same planet we are.
He was more than Leonardo. He worked on things for years.
Well, here's the other thing, too, about, and I talked about depression in the book, because a lot of my students are on Prozac. A lot of my students are in therapy. I was clinically depressed in my 20s, suicidal. I thought that there was no way out. And what I think is, when you tend to be creative, you tend to feel things more deeply. And I think when you write poetry, or you feel down, and you feel a little bit more like writing poetry or doing stuff, if there's this stuff inside that you want to get out, whether it's your photography or writing or whatever. And I think if you spend every day on that side and you're filling your head with negative self-talk or looking at the world in kind of a negative place, it's really easy to lose, in Robin Williams' case, objectivity as to, is life worth living? And that's when you have things like that. And we've lost a lot of great actors recently through depression and drug abuse. And honestly, I think the best thing that came out of it is that mental illness and depression is something that people think that if you've never been there, you can just snap out of it and just, you know, stop thinking depressed thoughts, right? It's that easy. It's not. And the more you spend on that side of your brain, now, are drugs the answer? No. I think drugs, and I say this in my talk, drugs are an access road. But if all you have is a negative highway, that you're just going to jump right back on that negative highway, and then you're going to go back and go, they're not working, so they increase the dosage. If you don't create a positive highway, somewhere else to go for your brain, then you're going to be trapped in this negative highway access road thing that I see with a lot of artists. So we need to teach our kids how to create positive highways, positive self-talk, so when life's events happen, they have somewhere else to go other than this negative.
And being an artist is cool. And if you don't have great math, or you don't have a great memory from 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, sure. It's okay. You can do that. I want to add, you know who Charles Grodin is, the actor? He was at Juilliard with Christopher Reeve, Dustin Hoffman, all those guys. He wrote a book about 20 years ago. And in it he said, you do not see the greatest artists on movies. They are not there. The best artists at Juilliard did not have the perseverance and the stomach to take the rejection that it takes to make it a business. So we don't see the greatest. They're casualties of the machine, if you will. Which is why we hope to not make Hollywood movies. We hope to produce something here and not go through all that BS.
You know, this has been great, great discussion, and I think we could go all night, but they're going to kick us out of the restaurant. So one more question, and please keep the answer.
Hello. How did you find your positive outlet?
Two more questions.
What I did was I woke up every day and I really thought life wasn't living, and I had a plan. I said, well, I could kill myself today, and at the end I said, well, if today doesn't work out, I could kill myself tomorrow. So procrastination kind of kept me alive. I picked up a book, and it's How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And he, in the book, and then I found Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. And I started reading these books, and there was a way that I said, my brain can really determine the outcome in my life. And I said, you know, I just don't know how to use my brain. And that's the reason we wrote the book, because I think if creatives and other people can learn how to use their brain better, they're going to lead happier, more fulfilled lives. And that's something, our technology has exploded, but
But really, we haven't changed as human beings much in our interaction in over 300 years. And I wish that type of technology would innovate as well in our relationships and in our...
It's a mission. He was the missionary. He started the church, but I'm a missionary now. I believe creativity is the answer to marital issues, business issues, money issues. We got to do something different. This is where we are. Okay, that's what we did to get there. Let's try something different, whether it's the Middle East or other. We got one more question. Thanks.
Yeah, just one comment here. How do you feel ego either affects creativity, either positively or negatively?
So you want me to do it real quick, or you? I'll do it real quick. Whenever I get into a real bad problem, here's what I tell myself. I'm a genius. And I have figured things out that I didn't know how to do. I said short answer. I'll try to tell this story as fast as I can. I was working on a project. I was teamed with a computer science guy. He was supposed to do all the programming. I was supposed to do the art. 4 o'clock in the morning, client's coming at 9 a.m. I look over, he's asleep. Nobody's there to do the programming. I don't get paid unless the client's happy in the morning. So I go, crap. So I go, I'm a genius. And I start writing code, compound interest, trying to figure out how to make the thing work right. By the morning the client came, I figured it out. Right? If you do not tell yourself you can do it, you won't.
I wanted to add to that. The amount of rejection, the amount of, you have one idea, good. You have five ideas, better. You have 10 ideas, and you got to pick one. What is my desired outcome? And you got to believe in yourself, because it's not going to, kind of the opposite of that, but the same thing. It's not going to all be genius. And can I take notes? I'm writing a feature script now. Director of photography notes, director notes, co-writer notes. Actor notes, do I have the ego to handle all that input and still do it what I want to do, even though I might get some criticism? And so you have ego in terms of the positive, what ego can be.
Right.
I am strong enough, I'm a worthy human being, whether y'all laughed at my jokes or not. This is a test for me every time I speak. Can I handle that kind of rejection? So I do it to myself. And you find good comedians do that too. They get up there and they bomb purposely to see if they can handle it.
I'm going to leave you with a quote. I put this on my wall. If it's important to you, you'll find a way. If not, you'll find an excuse.
Yep. Good. Copies of our book are available up here, and thank you.